Welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, episode 13. Today on the show, I have Jeff Moyer, owner at Dynamic Correspondence Sports Training. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is an online athletic performance technology shop distributing items such as the FreeLap Timing System, GymAware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the SpeedMat. I've gotten many of these items from Simply Faster and can confidently say that they make today's best training technology available to everybody. The FreeLap Timing System has revolutionized both my practices and my athlete assessments, allowing me to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds. It is wireless, compact, portable, and incredibly versatile. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are fantastic tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that go beyond the traditional weight room. The 1080 Sprint is being used by great coaches training some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and it truly represents high-performance speed training. I can personally attest that Simply Faster's customer service is second to none. Christopher at Simply Faster responds quickly to queries, and anyone who makes a purchase from Simply Faster is in good hands. If you want to acquire some of the best high-tech training equipment available, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's simply with an I, faster.com. They are the future of coaching technology. Thanks for tuning in today. Jeff Moyer is our guest for episode 13. He is the owner of Dynamic Correspondence Sports Training, and there at DC Sports Training, Jeff is doing some great work not only on the physical weight room abilities of his athletes, but also their skill acquisition, speed, special strength, as well as vision training. So Jeff is doing a lot of great things and a lot of really cutting edge training that I think we can all benefit from learning a little bit more about. I met Jeff a few years ago at the Central Virginia Sports Performance Seminar. Jeff has been on Jay DeMeo's podcast a few times in regards to things like the 1x20 system and vision training. He has a chapter in the manual, Volume 1, which recently came out, which is the Central Virginia Sports Performance handbook, if you will, and which is excellent, by the way. I would definitely recommend checking it out. And he wrote a little bit in the manual about skill training and acquisition in sport. And being a track coach, strength coach myself, the idea of motor learning, cueing, how do we get athletes to not only lift weights better, which is often very conscious and slow driven, but how do we get them to play sports better, which is fast, hindbrain driven material. And Jeff does a great job with that. He's got some great ideas that we're going to chat about. The topics that we are going to cover today are going to be things like the effectiveness of the 1x20 system, special strength training for speed, common speed errors, internal and external cueing for athletes based on things like left-right brain dominance. That's a really fascinating one, so make sure you listen all the way up till Jeff chats about that. And of course, vision training. If you haven't heard of vision training, it's kind of hard to describe over a podcast, so I did include a video in the show notes. Be sure to check that one out. But be sure to check out some of the things and resources Jeff steers you towards. I think that vision training is going to definitely be a very, very important in the future of sports performance, because Jeff describes it as a bit of a pie. We have our physical abilities, mental abilities, brain abilities. And if you're missing out on vision, you're missing out on a huge, huge chunk of the athletic performance equation. So I'm really excited for this one. Jeff is a great guy, smart coach, relentless learner, and we can all learn a lot from him. So let's get on to the show. All right, Jeff, thanks for being on the show today. Glad to have you here.
Yeah, thank you so much, Joel. I really, really appreciate it, man. This means a lot.
Awesome. So we'll get started right away. And you wrote a great article or question and answer recently for my site, Just Fly Sports, and I think you had a lot of great points. And some of the things that I think a lot of users and listeners are interested in is the 1x20 method. And anytime you hear something that says, you know, one set is all you need in terms of modern strength practice, a lot of people that's out there in left field. But I think the more that we hear people who are actually using it and seeing success with it, the more it makes sense for us. And so could you share a little bit about your initial experience with 1x20, how you got there, and how that's evolved over the years, if it has, or if you're still doing kind of the standard methodology there?
Yeah, man. I played college sports, ran track and played college football. We did Olympic lifting. And then when I got out of college, I wanted to continue playing football to try out for, you know, like arena combine, and we did kind of like a, the guy had me doing like a kind of a CrossFit type of thing. And then I got to actually offer to coach college football at Hamilton College in upstate New York and learned about the conjugate method of Louis Simmons and Westside Barbell and Elite Fitness and Jim Wendler and all these guys. So started doing that. So strength has kind of been important, you know, strength. And then right before I was about to leave Hamilton College, I went to New Jersey to Bergen Catholic and listened to Buddy Morris present and listened to James Smith present. And I never really heard James before. I knew he wrote, you know, he was the thinker for Elite FTS, but never heard him speak before. And I literally didn't understand a single thing he said, but I wanted to. And everyone, I was inspired by how in awe of everyone was of him with his words and, you know, just his knowledge. So I want to be that. I want people to feel that way about when I talk. So I started researching all that stuff, and that's when I found Ultimate Athlete Concepts and Yosef Johnson. So I reached out to him, and he was kind enough to talk to me about, you know, his background, and he's done training with high school and college athletes. And then at that time, I was going from Hamilton College down to the private sector, so I was working in a sports medicine orthopedic practice. So I was the continuation after injury with athletes from the PT to athletic trainer to me. And I really believed in, and at that time, that's when 5-3-1 was becoming real big, Jim Wendler. So I knew that using lower intensities, strength training really did get great results. James presented on it, and the 5-3-1 was becoming so popular. So I didn't really want to do the West Side anymore. That was kind of, I went out and spent time with Louis and Dave Tate, and I'm certified at West Side, this and that. But I didn't like the way I felt, and our football team at Hamilton wasn't winning. And it's not to say that was because of the West Side and stuff like that, but I didn't really see a transfer of training with, and we had kids. We had a kid, raw box squat, 800 pounds. We had three raw box squat, 700-pound kids, like 4, 5, 600 pounds. I mean, we bought a mono rack for the gym. We had every, you know, strength tool imaginable there. But it just didn't seem like it was transferring. And so I started talking. I started using 5-3-1, and I was getting into, you know, James Smith and Buddy were talking highly of Charlie Francis. So I was using Charlie Francis and 5-3-1. Stuff with a football team I started working with, you know, I and good results. And then I was talking with Yosef, and I was like, hey man, you know, what do you do? Because you work with kids about the same age as me and level as mine. And he said, well, I just do one by 20. I said, what the shit is that, man? What are you talking about, 1x20? That's crazy talk, man. You got to do at least 3 sets or 5 sets and this and that. He's like, yeah, 1x20, and here's my results. And he just started spitting off 40 times and vertical jumps and all that stuff. Not just strength numbers, but he started spitting that stuff off. This is what my son does. His son was a training to be a boxer, and this is what he squats. And he squats like 450 for 14 reps. And, you know, these crazy stupid numbers. Like, holy shit, man. So I decided to, with half the football team, try it. Just try 1x20, and the other half stay with the 5-3-1. That way, if 1x20 didn't work, I wasn't in too much trouble with half the football team. And every 8 weeks, I would try to test in single leg broad jumps and vertical jumps. You know, being upstate New York, it's winter about 10 months out of the year up there, so I can't go outside and time them all the time. So that's what we did. And every 8 weeks, we would measure, and the group that did 1x20 would improve, I don't know, man, the math, 3 to 5 times better than the 5-3-1. It's not that the 5-3-1 didn't improve, but the numbers just were higher of improvement with the 1x20. And after the second 8 week testing, I just decided to freaking transfer everybody over to that. And then we did all the measurements from before the off season to right before the season, and we took off about 0.4 seconds on average with 30 kids on their 40s, and that was with veritable attendance, really shitty attendance. I had a lot of 2-3 sport athletes, yada yada. And we went 9-0 that year, and they hadn't had a winning season in like 15 years. So I saw a transfer. Again, I'm not saying that was the reason why we went 9-0, but I saw a transfer And so we did it again the next year and got the exact same results with the exact same group of kids, and we went 10-1. So in two seasons, we went 19-1. So I saw the transfer of training, and then that kind of, I mean, it just hooked me. I saw how it worked, you know, and I went out and spent time with Dr. Yestis and saw how he worked with his hands and how he trained athletes and stuff, and it just fascinated me. You know, people listen to Doc and this and that, and they think he's a kooky old man who just mechanics, but they don't understand that he is a genius with the whole thing. The mechanics is just a part of it that not a lot of people are talking about. He assumes that you understand the general training. That's why he doesn't talk about it. He assumes we all get that. People just think he's mechanics and specialized exercise, but he's so much more than that. And I saw firsthand things he's done and what he does with athletes. So I was hooked. So that's what really just sold me on all that.
That's awesome. And it's always great to be able to, and I've seen this done with football teams before, like coaches will split the offense and defense and say, okay, you do this, you do this. It's like being in a little bit of online marketing, there's always the A/B testing, and they stress that so much. So it's great that you're able to do that. Why do you think it is? You are one of the preeminent stories of the 1x20 that has gotten me thinking about it over the last couple of years. I've heard it from a few other coaches, and I've seen what Jay's done with some of his basketball players. And why do you think it is that the 1x20 works so well compared to the other strength methods? I guess there could be a variety of reasons, but what's your thoughts on why you're seeing better dynamic performance?
I mean, the program itself is, you know, the 1x20 and this and that, but to me, it's more of it's principles. You know, it's that old Ralph Waldo Emerson, you know, the man who grasps principles understands, you know, methods better rather than just having a bunch of methods. It's principles. So it's, you know, what is the least amount you need to get better? So I don't know, man. I mean, there's the science of it builds capillary density. It strengthens the connective tissues and ligaments more, which, I mean, I don't know a lot of physiology. I'm not a physiology major or anything like that, but I know reading, I have all Viru's, Aku Viru's books, Adaptation Sports Training, and his two volumes of, you know, that he talks about low intensity strength training too close to failure strengthens connective tissues better. And I know in 1x20, you know, 20 reps, it's hard to get blood flow to ligaments and tendons. So I know, you know, that 20 to 25 rep range, you know, it really does get that. And then as we progress down, you know, I mean, ligaments and tendons, everyone knows that's kind of important for speed and power. So I think it builds that better than conventional, just, you know, 3 sets of 10, 5 sets of 5. You know, 12, 8, 6, 4, you know, that the whole thing. So from that, and it's efficient, man. It's we can get anywhere up to 20 to 30 exercises done in a workout. So globally, it strengthens the whole organism better, I feel, because we're doing literally covering everything that an athlete has to do. Hip abduction, adduction, knee drive, paw back, dorsiflexion, plantar flexion, you know, everything, protraction, retraction, elevation, depression, scapulas, you name it. It gets everything because we have, you know, we have one set. It's very efficient. And it's not beating the shit out of the kids. It really just kind of gets that level of adaptation. It touches upon that rather than, you know, 3 sets of 10. You know, I know Kier, the rugby strength coach, my man Kier talks about, you know, if I can get you to buy a car, you know, for $3,000, you know, but you're willing to pay 10, you know, why would you pay 10, you know, when you can just get it for $3,000? So if I can get you strong with one set of 20 or one set of 14 or one set of 8, why would you do 3 sets of 10? You know what I mean? You know, that works up later. So we, with the 1x20, with the principles, it works up to multiple sets later on. But to start, that's 1x20. That's just the starting point, man. That's just the jump off. That's really what it is. And then it just moves from there. So I have had athletes that, professional high division 1, 2 athletes that might do one set of 20 for 2 weeks just to kind of build that little base, so to speak. And then we go off to, you know, more conventional type of things, you know, 2 sets, 3 sets of things and stuff. So I don't know, I guess I'm now biased to it, obviously, but, I just think it's more efficient and it does things differently. You know, the capillary density, we've seen huge increases in just conditioning and work capacity. I mean, dude, you do a set of 20 step ups, you do a set of 20 squats, GHRs, that's a ball buster, man. It builds work capacity. And then you get down to one set of 8. Shit, that's easy. You know, the kids are, that's a breeze in the park. And that's why, you know, all my athletes love it when they go down to one set of 14 or one set of 8, because it's nothing. You know, we get into the speed work. We get into, you know, doing flying 60s, doing stuff like that, doing plyometric depth jumps and all that. They're not even phased. They're not breezed by it because they were doing sets of 20 and stuff. So the conditioning aspect of it is just kind of built in. So yeah, I'll just kind of leave it at that, man.
Yeah, that's awesome. Two quick questions following up on that. One is, what is the typical rep tempo you're doing on those 1x20 and 1x14 sets? How fast are those athletes performing that?
I generally just keep it nice and easy on the way down and then come up as fast as they can, obviously under control. You know, I now have a gym aware, which we've been playing around with. So I've been trying to see, you know, I'm not a scientist or a data collector per se, but just curious, you know, you do a set of 20, is there a break, a drop off in speed, you know, and stuff like that. And it's relatively pretty consistent, you know, but, yeah, nice and easy down, fast on the way up. That's really it. Dr. Yeses, actually, I have it from 1963. I can send it to you. He wrote his doctoral thesis kind of on this. It's on the speed and endurance continuum with weights. You know what I mean? Everyone assumes with weight training, okay, well, eights are for, you know, or, you know, 1 to 5 is for, you know, it's kind of that strength thing. 1 to 5 is max strength. 8 reps is, you know, sub-max strength. 14 is hypertrophy, and so anything else is endurance. Well, Dr. Yeses wrote his whole doctoral thesis on it's more of a continuum. You know what I mean? So you work on the early phases with the lighter, you know, the beginning part of 20 reps, and it's lighter. That's more the speed strength, you know, starting strength, speed strength stuff. And then as it gets towards more of the failure part, that's where you get your real strength. So it kind of works this continuum. And I'll share with you his doctoral thesis on it. So that's in – I can tell you – doing one set of 20 for, I've measured it. I usually go every 8 workouts, but sometimes 8 to 12 workouts in that rep range without doing a single jumping exercise, any kind of explosive exercise, and retesting broad jumps or vertical jumps. Kids average 5 to 6 inches in their broad jump and 1 to 2 in their vertical jump, just doing one set of 20 and stuff like that. You know, so again, it kind of works that continuum of speed, power, endurance, everything in that. Rather than just saying, well, 20 reps is just endurance. Now it kind of gets that whole continuum. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's good stuff. And you'll have to, if you can get me that, doctoral work, I'll have to get that in the show notes so people listening can go check it out. I think that the whole idea of higher reps has been fascinating to me, not only the weight room, but plyometric type work, any sort of plyo endurance, speed, strength, endurance, if you will. And the idea of internal load and how the brain has to modulate what's happening when the internal load changes because particular muscles are fatigued. And I think that that's such an interesting world that I think the 1x20 sheds some light on, as well as other things too.
Absolutely.
You had mentioned a little bit, Jeff, about you with some of your football players doing 1x20 for a few weeks and then going into more regular work. Do you... what's your experience with maybe phasing in and out like 1x20? It kind of what you had mentioned before.
Yeah. Well, so for instance, you know, you asked kind of where I've progressed or, you know, evolved with it. I've gotten smarter with it. And then, with that, you know, like for instance, it's kind of a needs-based program, so to speak. So everything, if I'm working with a higher level athlete, collegiate athlete, professional athlete, whatever, we look at their mechanics. So like, for instance, I'll give you this example of a running back we did last, I started with last summer. I had 6 weeks to start with him right before camp. So not a lot of time. I've now been with him for over a year, so I can give you all the numbers. But first thing we did was looked at how he ran. I mean, he wanted to improve his 40 time, and that was the objective. Okay, well, so we watched him run. I did a biomechanical assessment using Dr. Yeses, and based off of that, that's what we found his strengths and weaknesses. So his program was geared towards improving those particular things. But we started with 1x20 for 2 weeks, build a base, and then we split it up where that 1x20 was 3 times a week, and he was only running a mile on those every other day, just for some aerobic conditioning for recovery purposes, yada, yada, yada. And then we split it upper, lower, you know, Monday, lower, Tuesday, upper, rest Wednesday to Thursday, up, lower, Friday, upper. And that's when we got into the multiple sets things, based off of what he needed. He needed to improve his knee drive. He wasn't driving his thighs nearly high enough. He was extending at his knee, so which tells me he wasn't necessarily using his the ankle joint extension well enough. And knowing him, he had a history of ankle sprains and stuff like that, so you can kind of see it. So he's doing more leaping than actually pushing off, so we needed to do more calf raise stuff. And his paw back wasn't sufficient, where his shin would whip out and literally just kind of drop rather than this forceful back and down, and he wasn't landing underneath his hips. So that's kind of an indicator of his lack of paw back. And his lower back, he had pretty terrible posture. And the kid came to me, and he could squat 405 for 3 or 4 reps as a high schooler, but he couldn't do more than 7 reps on the GHR. You know, he couldn't do more than 10 reps on the back raise. So those were areas. So the 1x20 principle, you know, we started with that. And then the principle is, what is the least amount we needed? So we started with splitting it up so we could get multiple sets. Now with multiple sets, he needs a little more rest. So that's kind of the idea with that. And then we worked on, you know, incorporating sled sprints and flying sprints and stuff like that. We took his flying 60 from a 6.58 down to a 6.21. We took his 10 yard from a 1, and this is all using the free lap, by the way. Thanks, Christopher. And his electronic 10 yard went from like a 3 point stance, 1.7 to like a 1.58 or 1.56 or something like that in 6 weeks. So not bad. You know what I mean? But the principle of the 1x20 is just kind of what is needed and what is the least amount you need to use to get him better, so to speak. And so working in multiple sets now, that's kind of where that works. He needed multiple sets with paw back and calf raises and knee drives, really.
Yeah, it's lifting, the illustration of lifting as a drug. And I think a lot of people, you know, don't think about that often, because if you have too much of a drug, then it's not going to be helpful. It's harmful, and those special exercises are less stressful than a set of squats. So you can do that.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, you don't give chemotherapy for a cold, so to speak. You know what I mean? So what is the least amount? I mean, it's, you know, it's written about training hormesis. You know, hormesis is a low dose of toxin that yields a positive adaptation. You know, so strength training is kind of the exact same thing. You know, what is the least amount of stress we need to do to get this better person better? Now, the interesting thing with stress and adaptation, and kind of wrote about that, it's, you know, I feel, especially with lower athletes and higher, but there's a separate threshold for adaptation than there is for recovery. And I feel that the adaptation threshold is lower. Most people, so coaches, I feel, chase the recovery one and overstep the adaptation one. And I'm just looking for adaptation. What gets them better? What moves the ticker in the direction we want it, man? That's really all I give a shit about it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So you're talking about the adaptation recovery, just to clarify too, and maybe help me out a little bit. Are you talking more about adaptation on the neural level, like what the brain needs to adapt, versus recovery is in like the hormonal stuff, or like doing all the you know, sleep and hydrotherapy and all that stuff down the road, or what? How, can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, so adaptation meaning what just gets the results better and what we're trying to measure. That's really, I mean, yes, all that. You're smarter than me, man. So I don't even know what you just said, but just what gets the results better and what we're trying to measure. For him, it was his speed. That's what we're trying to measure. So I was just, what gets the ticker moving in that direction? As a byproduct of that, I feel everything else kind of falls into place with the recovery. I know some people chase adaptation based off of what a mega wave says, or heart rate variability. If you know what I mean, this and that. Okay, well, he's green, so that means we can do this. And what is the cost of doing work and all that stuff? But and I get that, but I feel if you just concentrated solely on the results, the recovery will kind of take care of itself.
Yeah. Thanks for highlighting my need to overcomplicate things from every now and then. But no, just giving me a hard time. That reminds me of something that Carl Valley said on the show not too long ago, that data is more important than I'm trying to remember this. He's going to kill me. But basically, your training data is more important than all the monitoring that we do. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say.
Exactly. No, I mean, yeah, Carl said it better than me. Yeah, that's it right there, man. Just what does the data say? Just are we moving what we're trying to measure in the direction that we want? And that's all that we should be concerned with. That's really it.
I was going to ask you about vision, and I will, but you had mentioned the football player and super strong, but some of the deficiencies in running technique and whatnot. And I think that something that I was looking forward to asking you and talking to you about, because I've read some great articles you've written in regards to special strength training, speed, and how to correct in those regards. And so you're familiar with those methods of Dr. Yeses. What are some examples, or what are some specialized speed exercises that you found useful in correcting technical errors, and what are some common flaws that you can will typically look for?
So I work with predominantly, middle school, high school kids. I've had college, D1, D2, D3, pro, semi-pro, yada yada. But I work primarily. So for me, what I see maybe technically might be a little different than maybe what you see or Jay sees or other people see. But for me, the biggest technical thing that I see with youth athletes is they run on their heels, man. They just pound the shit out of their heels. Why that is, I don't know. I want to blame modern shoes, but I don't know if that's I don't know all the science behind that crap, but they just pound the shit out of their heels. All the braking forces it sends, up the leg. A lot of kids have patellotendinitis or jumper's knee and stuff like that. That's usually a number one, the biggest mechanical flaw we see. Everything else, honestly, this might sound a little arrogant, but the 1x20 program just kind of fixes it. As far as general and specialized exercises, Verkhoshansky writes about there's two types of exercises to him. There's exercise for key movements, and then there's secondary exercises. Key movements are the exercises that improve the power output in the competition exercise. So Dr. Yeses kind of took that, and with his biomechanics and expertise in kinesiology, he says the three key movements are the ankle joint extension for the push off, the knee drive, and the pull back. Everything else is kind of secondary. So I see weaknesses a lot of times in the key movements, the knee drive. Coaches always want kids to drive their thighs higher, and they do a lot of wall drills, and they'll do a lot of drills where the athletes are picking up their knees. But what that does is create a lot of vertical motions, and they're going up and down rather than horizontal. If I'm trying to improve acceleration and speed, I want them going A to B, not, A, B, and C. So working on the knee drive and how to do that and everything like that. The paw back, just getting to be more forceful with bringing their foot back and down, landing, first of all, not on their heels, whether it's a whole foot, a midfoot, strike, and landing underneath their hips. You'll see weaknesses with that. So Doc has specialized exercises to improve that, and then general to improve that. The way he does GHRs are different than what's out there conventionally. You see, and this is not a knock on the way it's performed conventionally, it's just different. First of all, Dr. Yeses, I don't know if a lot of people know this, he actually created the GHR exercise and the machine. For whatever reason, he got bad business advice and he didn't get a patent, and now that's why there's 100 million different GHR machines out there. But he created the original one, and the way it's performed is the athlete hangs over and hangs down, kind of like an old pommel horse, if you've seen all the old Russian Soviet pictures and stuff like that, where their feet are locked in. And now where their hip athlete's hips falls is important. You want the axis of rotation to be in the origin of the hamstring. So not having the hips on the pad is important. Having the hips in front of the pad, so now the axis of rotation is in the origin of the hamstring. They do a hip extension, and then they come up to a back raise, and then they bend their knees. So now it creates a double contraction at both ends of the hamstrings, which is, far greater than just a single contraction, where like the way Elite Fitness or Westside do it is just kind of a glorified knee curl.
Okay.
The Nordic knee curl. It just gets the insertion of the hamstring. Right, it doesn't get both ends, where this actually gets both ends. And I was talking with Hank Kreisenhoff this year down at Virginia. He did his presentation on hamstrings and recovery and everything like that. But no one has studied that exercise. And I've been interested by an EMG to measure hamstring muscle activity during that exercise, because anyone who's done it the way Dr. Yeses presents it, and feel free to contact these people, Joseph Johnson, Matt Tomey, Ryan Bracious, Jada Mayo, Brian Matthews. They will all tell you, we've never had athletes have hamstring injuries. I can honestly say that. It gets both ends of the hamstrings. It's not just an RDL or a good morning. It's not just a knee curl. It gets both ends of it. And it's a relative strength exercise, which I feel is important. And then the knee drive exercise using the rubber tubing. Now you can also hook it up to a pulley system. You can do it, in different fashions. A lot of people look at the specialized exercises that Doc does and they assume it's just there's one way of doing it. There's actually a lot of ways of doing the specialized exercises, whether it's just your conventional strength training way. You can do it for muscular endurance, local muscle endurance. You can do it explosively. You can do it plyometric, or you can do it, the static dynamic fashion where we hold and then release, so to speak, kind of, the Jay Schroeder popular, way that he likes to do things. So there's a lot of different ways to do things, those exercises, which is pretty cool. But I would say, to answer your question, sorry, roundabout it, look at if they're running on their heels. First and foremost, I can honestly say, hand to God, I've never assessed or met an athlete who complains of knee pain that did not run on their heels. I've never met an athlete who has knee pain that did not run on their, or that runs on the balls of their feet. That's usually, and again, I could be wrong. I'm just saying, in my experience, in 6 years of now studying under Dr. Yeses, this is what I have seen. Now, how to take care of that's all different. We can talk about that. But, so for me, getting an athlete and shin splints, if you look at a lot of athletes with shin splints, there's a high correlation of them running the heels. Now, there's two causes of injuries to athletes: poor mechanics and poor physical abilities as it relates to the mechanics. So if they're not running on their heels and they suffer shin splints, then I just look at their anterior tibialis and I look at doing a bunch of different, exercises for that. Posterior tibialis, anterior tibialis, and all those fun ankle exercises. But yeah, I would say heel striking, and then just the specialized exercise kind of just improve everything else. The knee drive will necessarily improve. The pull back will kind of improve.
So you were saying even the one by 20 though, just by itself, like doing squats and stuff, seems to be able to improve that heel striking.
Well, yeah, because the way we squat, is I don't know if it's different, but it's people call, I know Cal Dietz calls it a sports back squat. Your feet are underneath your hips, and we're not as wide, and don't get me wrong, we're trying to get down to parallel, but it's hard to get down to parallel when your feet are on your hips, and if you're tall and long legged like me. I'm 6'2". I think you're a tall fellow as well. It's hard to get down to parallel like that with keeping the integrity of the squat, where I'm not rounding, I'm not a posterior pelvic tilt, and I'm not coming off my heels, and my knees aren't going like super past my toes. That's how we squat. And that, that on top of other things. Because when you run, when you strike the ground with your foot, it's in relation to your hips. It's not outside your hips. It's not toes pointed. It shouldn't be. Toes pointed out should be in relation to how wide your hips are. So that's why we squat with our feet underneath our hips like that. And plus, same with vertical jumps and same with broad jumps. So I feel that's another reason why, from a method standpoint with the 1x20, my athletes were able to improve more in the vertical and broad jumps than with the 5-3-1 version, because we were squatting kind of powerlifting conventional.
Yeah, that makes great sense. And I think that highlights just how important it is. You're getting 20 solid reps with an increasing internal load, and it's in the right position with feet under the hips. It also brought me back to what you were saying about the 20 reps being good for connective tissue, if like that's increasing the spring ability in that position. And that's cool stuff. I hadn't thought about that before.
Yeah. That, and then again, the way we do GHRs, and we do a lot for calves. I know, your buddy Chris Corfus and Dan talk about ankle rocker and stuff like that. We do a lot for ankles, both standing calf raises and bent knee calf raises, which I think is one of the most underrated exercises out there. I don't see a lot of coaches or talking or doing bent knee calf raises to help improve dorsiflexion stuff. And then we do back raises and all the secondary aspects of the movement, according to Verkhoshansky. But the three key ones, according to Verkhoshansky and Yeses, are ankle doing stuff for the ankles, for the push off, the knee drive, and the paw back, help put force into the ground. So it's that cyclical nature. I know, was it? Correct me if I'm wrong. I could be completely wrong. Was it Whalen? I know came out with a paper a long time ago talking about it's the amount of force you put into the ground. But then I think he retracted it in another article a few years later saying it's not just that, it's the cyclical nature in which the elite athletes do that. And that's what Dr. Yeses has been saying since Jump Street. You know, it's not just the force, it's the cyclical nature. Because if it was just force, powerlifters would be the strongest goddamn people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's the interesting thing. Doc's been doing the cyclical action of the running motion.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember the Wayne study. I don't remember the retraction. I guess I wasn't in the research world at that point. I was just talking with JB Marin on the last podcast, and he was talking a little bit about that, how the efficiency of being able to still put horizontal force into the track at, you know, once you're accelerating, and it's not just the raw distribution, it's the efficiency of the distribution.
Yeah, and then Jada Mayo, oh God, I can't think of the guy's name, I apologize, the gentleman from University of Wisconsin who's doing the research on hamstring injuries and preventions, found that it's the pawback action when the foot strikes the ground is where most common hamstring injuries occur. Well, that's why Dr. Yeses, that's one of the reasons why Dr. Yeses, we do a pawback exercise to help strengthen that action of bringing the foot back and down. And from a technical standpoint, it helps the athlete feel bringing the foot back and down. And, you know, if we're trying to change mechanics, they have to have some sensory information to feel the difference between the old way and the new way. So,
yeah, no doubt. Jeff, you wrote a great section in the manual that Jada Mayo put together with the Central Virginia Sports Performance Seminar, and all about training skills, the brain, how do we get athletes to acquire skills and fix technique. And so, kind of piggybacking off what you had just said, what's your philosophy on changing technique in athletes who are deficient? You probably mentioned it a little bit already with some of the specialized exercises, but could you go into your philosophy a little bit more in that area?
Yeah, dude. See, for me, this is I love this, man. This improving or changing an athlete's technique and getting it to become unconscious is honestly more enjoyable to me than just getting a kid, you know, who's never done a push-up to do 50. Or, you know, I mean, you name a physical thing, but just I love that. I really do. So I love this. And this is where when I went out and spent time with Dr. Yeses, I feel people don't know how much of an expert he is in motor learning. So, okay, I've researched the shit out of motor learning, and there's so much out there now with dynamical systems theory and ecological psychology and constraints-led approach and movement variability and all this stuff, but there's not a lot on how to fix errored movement. I think Paul Baxter is the only person I've read that's done research and written things on how to do that. And I don't think he has it anymore. He had a website, was it coachingprotocols.com, and he sold the old way, new way method. And he has, I know, ebooks out there and little pamphlets on how to do that. Highly recommend it. So, okay, if we have an athlete, let's say, who runs on their heels, well, how do you get them to not run on their heels? That is fucking hard, man. Pardon my language, but that is not an easy task. They need, first of all, they need to be aware, right? They have to be aware that they're doing it, and you have to explain to them why that's bad and get them to feel that. So a little simple test I'd like to do, and anyone who's listening right now who wants to do it, stand up, pick up your toes, keep your toes up, and jump on your heels up and down three times is high as you can. All right. Think about what that feels like once you've done it. Now, pick up your heels, stand on your toes, and jump up and down three times as high as you can. Aside from the obvious, you know, you're jumping higher on your toes, it should feel softer, right? That's the key, right? It is hard. You're sending so many braking forces up your legs and everything. So when an athlete feels that, they go, oh shit, that hurts. You know what I mean? Or just have them take off their shoes and run on their heels. That hurts. They'll complain about how much that hurts because modern shoes take away sensory information, and I don't like modern shoes. So you have to make them aware. And then they have to feel the difference. I mean, that's really the big thing. If they can't feel the difference, they're just going to revert back. So we start kind of using, I guess, more of a conventional top-down approach, so to speak, I guess, a little bit with the motor learning of bringing cognition first, and then they have to feel the difference, and then we kind of work up from there. So we start low, we start slow. We don't do it for more than 2 to 5 minutes. It's all based off of how well they're practicing. And then we stop, and then we'll come back. So it's kind of using that random practice rather than blocked practice. And we do it, I don't know, multiple sessions. I tell the kids, practice it 5 times a day for 2 minutes. You know what I mean? Just get off your heels, run on your toes, whether it's in the hallway, at home, going upstairs, whatever. Just practice it. You know what I mean? Think about it. I'll have them do it before they go to bed. Think about it. Because there's a lot of research out there showing that motor learning before bed helps with the learning process. So getting them to feel that, and then we work up in speed, because with increases in speed, you lose sensory information, and you know, the kids go back to their old way. So we work up in speed. Once we get a kid worked up to a full sprint linearly, then we'll start doing different things. Now that's when we kind of got to start getting into that little bit of a dynamical systems theory, changing the environment, so to speak. So we'll do, you know, have them chase a ball if they can, or have them run with someone. If they can run with someone and have a conversation and still not run on their striking their heels first, you know what I mean? That means it's moved to me a little more in the forebrain. And then we'll have them chase a ball, and then I'll have them chase an opponent. This is just an example. You know, and then I'll have them go in different directions and stuff like that. And we slowly start increasing the stimuli. You know what I mean? So we'll go from a simple stimuli of a conversation to chasing a ball that's a little more chaotic, to chasing an opponent that's a little more chaotic, to chasing three opponents or whatever. So that's just an example of kind of, you know what I mean, of how to get it from that unconscious, incompetent to conscious, incompetent to that whole, you know, conscious, whatever.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you the three, but I know what you're saying.
That spectrum. So that's kind of just an example. We'll do that for throwing. We'll do that for, I know you work with tennis athletes, right? We'll do that for forehands, backhands, serves, all that. But kind of that whole process. And then the special, what's great, okay, so they need the sensory information of feeling what's wrong, that old way of doing it. And they need the sensory information of what the right way feels. And that's where, in my opinion, Dr. Yeses' genius is, where he's created these specialized exercises. Now, I know people don't call them specialized because it doesn't match Verkhoshansky's 5 criteria of dynamic correspondence, but it meets 3 of them, and it's closer to the 5 than any other exercise you can come up with. So to me, it's specialized. If you use just Bondarchuk's, it's specialized, developmental. You know what I mean? So it just depends on whose verbiage and crap you want to use. But to me, he's created, you know, so for the knee drive, I got to get an athlete feel what it's like to drive my thighs forward to get my knees up, or the paw back of not running my heel. So now he's created exercises with rubber tubing that could be very minimal. You know what I mean? So I can do it with very young kids. I can do it with 10-year-olds or 12-year-olds and get them to feel these things. And now they can feel the difference. And then when they do it after, you take off the band, you take off the harness or whatever, and they do it, it's like, holy shit. That eye-opening movement, you know, moment where the kids are just like, wow, this feels so much easier. I can feel this now. You know, it sticks in their brain. I say, use that feeling, you know, trying to make them aware of it's important to understand these feelings and get them to express in their own words what it feels like, because then you use their own words, because now they own it a little bit more. So, yeah, that's kind of...
that's great information. It what you're saying, it actually is almost ties together some things I've heard from both people I've had on the show, and then some of Nick Winkelmann's stuff that he's talked about with internal and external cueing. And that reminds me a little bit about what Matt Gifford said on episode 2 here, on how bringing it back to the warm-up, you know, creating a sensation, a feeling in the warm-up, and then you can use that later. And it sounds like it's the same thing, but it's a very specialized process.
So, and I just want to add this, if you don't mind, to the internal, external focus in cueing. A lot of people have made a lot of claims that external, and I know Gabriel Wolf had the book and this and that, but if you look, none of them is for fixing errant movements, you know, hard errant movements. And now in the manual, I wrote my chapter separating skills. So there's hard skills and soft skills. To me, let's talk about tennis, since we both work with tennis athletes, or you still do, right?
Yeah.
Okay, tennis athletes, just say forehand, for instance, okay? We're working with an athlete, and we have to improve their forehand. The hard skill is the perfect mechanics for their forehand. You know what I mean? The soft skill is now how it's implemented in the environment, how it's implemented into a match. So the hard skills is that weight transfer. Let's say it's a closed stance forehand. So the weight transfer from the back to the front, to the separation of the hips, the hip rotation, then the separation, and then the arms. That's all the hard movements. Those are the mechanical laws in which human nature should abide by. Those are, you know, how we move efficiently. Now, how they're used and the variability with that into the soft skills is, you know, where you create breath and where you create all that with the soft skills. And that's where I feel the dynamical systems approach worked. And that's where I feel the external focus is. No one really kind of explains hard skills and soft skills, except for Daniel Coyle, but I know he's not big with athletic development, but that's kind of where I don't know why. I'm not a smart person, but I feel that just makes sense to me, man. I don't know why. That just makes sense to me. So I feel internal focus is important for fixing, because you have to feel it. I can't get an athlete to change running on their heels, get them off their heels, if they can't feel it. If they can't, that's an internal thing, man. You have to feel it. You know, I can't be pretend you're running on hot coal and, you know, don't do it on your heels, or, you know what I mean? Like, I have to give them an internal focus. And then when it starts moving to more of an unconscious thing and we're working up in speeds or we're working on chasing things, that's where the external becomes. So I think not a lot of people specify the context in which to use these things that everyone's trying to popularize. We have to give context. Is this a new skill? Is this an old skill? Is this a soft skill? Is this a hard skill? What are we trying to improve here? And then let's give context. You know, and then even still, I know Hank Kreienhoff, talking with him, he says, and he said it with his Olympic sprinters, he uses internal cues sometimes because that's what they get. So it's dependent on the athlete, and that's where he measures right and left brain. You know, are they right brain and left brain, and what circumstances? And so I do that now too. We use a Scantron test, 40 questions to measure information processing. Are they right brain, left brain, integrated, mixed, and in what circumstances? So now I know how to talk to them better. So again, just use external or just use internal. Well, no, it doesn't work for everybody. Everyone's individual. So we do a quick assessment with my athletes of measuring right and left brain and then how to do that and in what circumstances.
Awesome. I've never heard of that before, but it's yeah. Very
human,
fascinating.
The Human Information Processing Survey. Check it out. It's cheap. It's very easy. It's 40 questions, and you get a whole idea of how the athlete processes stuff, you know, and what ways to better communicate. I mean, shit, having all this knowledge is great, but if I can't communicate with my athletes, who gives a shit? You know, so that's the big thing. So I learned that from Hank. That's pretty cool.
That's awesome. That's what it all comes down to, too, is how the athlete, you know, we're kind of the guardians of, or I've heard coaching as if we're like the ambassadors to the subconscious mind of the athlete, but it's really them who makes it happen. And yeah. With the right, so I'm actually curious. So with the right brain, yeah. A right-brained athlete, more like artistic, intuitive.
Spatial. You know what I mean? Maybe they like discovery. You know what I mean? So that's where kind of using a dynamical systems thing and using Sean Mishka's work of having the athlete kind of discover the right movement patterns might be best, where an athlete who's more left brain, you know, I have athletes that are 98% left brain, you know, so they're very analytical. They need to feel it. They need to think it. They need to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay, that's how it works for them. You know what I mean? So that's what I got to do. But again, just because maybe they're left brain doesn't mean that's every circumstance. Maybe they like, and so what's cool about the survey is it has all these different, are they conforming, non-conforming? Do they like open-ended things? Do they like closed? Do they like summaries, or do they like, you know, like that gives you this whole rundown of what works best. So it helps me come up with cueing and drills better for them.
That's awesome. That makes sense to me too. I've kind of been on a big external kick. But listening to you, actually, I start to realize my own bias in there, because I'm actually pretty right-brained. I'm ambidextrous, left-handed writer, and I love external stuff. Like, I love doing discovery courses for plyometrics, and I'm on this big kick. And I've always felt the most athletic in the context of being able to play sports a lot. But yeah, someone who's more analytical might not float their boat as much, and you have to know the difference.
Yeah, so that helps with the art of coaching, you know. Thank you, Hank.
Yeah, thank you, Hank. Good stuff. We'll have to get that survey in the show notes. Absolutely. I'm going to check it out. So I'd keep delaying the vision training that I want to get to, but I think we do have a few minutes, and
Yeah.
I'd like to chat with you about that. So in terms of, I'm just getting into the vision training. I know you've been doing it for quite a while and have some great insight there. So quickly, what got you into vision training, and what kind of results can coaches expect? Because I think vision training's been around for a while. A lot of people might be hesitant and say, "Oh, does it really do anything? Is this something you can train?" So if you could answer those and enlighten us in that area.
Yeah, man. Yeah, like you said, it's kind of been around. It hasn't really been talked about much, especially in the, physical preparation, strength and conditioning industry. But anything, to be totally honest with you, man, anything Josef Johnson's recommended to me has been gold. He's never, I mean, he steered me wrong once and he got me fired, but it's worked well. It worked out well because then he got me a job here in Pittsburgh and now I own my own gym and life is good. But he, anything he recommends is just gold, man. And he told me about Dr. Bill Harrison and the vision stuff. So I got a couple of his products. He sells some products and I started using it and it just kind of led to some questions. And so Dr. Bill Harrison, is a doctor of optometry out in Laguna Beach. He's worked for professional sports, but mostly baseball for like 50 years. Barry Bonds, Jason Giambi, Greg Maddux, you name the baseball player, he's worked with them. And he's got awesome, some of the best stories, man, on them. And so I reached out to him and he put me in contact with his son. And his son, Ryan, was a vision scout, so to speak, I guess, for the Toronto Blue Jays. And he was scouting a baseball player out near Pittsburgh. And he's like, "Hey, man, I'll swing by your gym." So he came to my gym. And I was working with an athlete quick, so he kind of walked over to a tennis athlete of mine who was a Division I tennis athlete who I've worked with since he was a sophomore in high school. And his backhand has always been his problem area on the court. And through Dr. Yeses, we've been technically working on it. We've done specialized exercises. It looks, in the ideal situation, and we kind of built it in perfect. But for whatever reason, it just keeps breaking down during matches and stuff. So while I'm working with this one athlete, he goes over. He doesn't know the tennis athlete, doesn't know him from a ham sandwich. And he goes, "Hey, man, come here. I want to see something real quick." Literally does something with a rubber band in his finger in 2 minutes, calls me over, and he goes, "I bet you that you struggle with off-speed shots to your backhand because you're always mechanically out in front and pulling the ball." And my jaw dropped, and this kid's jaws dropped. I'm like, "Holy shit, did you just do that, man? Like, wow." And he kind of went through it with us. And it was the use of people call it the Brock string, Dr. Harrison and Ryan call it eye track, whatever, that he did. And he was checking convergence and binocularity of the athlete. And he saw that for whatever reason, with his right eye, he was nearsighted, and his right eye was weak. It was nearsighted, but it was weak. He perceived things to be closer, but it wasn't as strong as his left. Well, what's the lead eye to the backhand for a right-handed athlete? Well, it's his right eye. If he's nearsighted, he's going to have a tendency to be out in front on off-speed shots. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
And
exactly.
so there you go. It was a perceptual issue, not the mechanical issue was due to perception. So my background with Yeses was like kind of just crumbled in front of me. Oh shit, man. You know what I mean? It's not just mechanics that I need to do. I need to do more. So, yeah, that threw me through a loop. So I started researching the shit out of everything Dr. Harrison and Ryan Harrison does. And I will say this, man, with the vision therapy, because it's their vision training, it's still, even though it's been around for a while, it's really now becoming, I'm sure you've seen this, more popular this day and age with more and more tools: DynaVision, Axon Sports, RightEye, fit lights, neuro tracker, neuro training, all these tools, and they're all great. And everybody wants these because they think it's their needs. But just like the 1x20, man, it's a system of principles. That's what I find is separates what they do from everything. Because once you understand their system of principles, then all the methods and the tools just are they're that's it. They're tools. They're not the means to an end. Or they're not the end. So now how to use the fit lights and how to use all these other tools fit into it. So that's what really got me into it when he just dropped my draw for this kid's backhand that I couldn't figure out for years. And so that woke me up. And so I just started researching shit out of that and all the tools that are out there, and studying the quiet eye technique by, oh God, I dropped her name. I think it's Joan Vickers, up in Canada, and all this stuff, man. So that's what got me into the vision training. And now, as far as to your second question, you know, what can coaches expect results? It's hard to necessarily quantify results. From what I've seen, with baseball, it's easier. I work with a lot of baseball and softball players. It's easier because you'll just see improved on-base performance, on-base average, and you'll see batting averages go up. I can honestly say with my baseball players and my softball players, I've seen we average, and this is no lie, 500% increase in batting average. You know, so kids are at 300% hitters are now 800% hitters. No lie, they just say they see the ball better. And same with my tennis athletes. So I'll say with tennis athletes, you'll see less errors. I see with baseball players, you'll see better decisions. Whether it's to take the pitch or not to take the pitch. Sorry, turn on my light here. Here we go. With quarterbacks, I work with a lot of high school quarterbacks and stuff like that. You'll see maybe quicker decisions and better multi-object tracking skills and peripheral vision and stuff. So that's, again, it's hard to quantify that. But when an athlete says that, you know, that's qualitative to me. So I'll take that.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I think once, and maybe vision training is something that's hard to talk about over a podcast. It's almost like you need to be showing this stuff, because people who are just listening to this on the way to work, it's hard to necessarily see. Obviously, when you bring that example, the tennis player, where you're trying to hit a backhand, and when your right eye is supposed to be seeing the ball far well, but it can't, then you're going to get skips. And I'm just touching the surface and experimenting with some like pencil push-ups and saccade type stuff, and you'll see some of the ways the eyes skip. But in terms of if you had kind of like the some of the main exercises you use in correcting, and and also maybe a good way to go is if there's a resource that you could point people who are interested to in vision training, like a website, what are some exercises, resources, or a website that people who are interested in vision training check out?
This is an indirect plug. I don't necessarily mean to just, I swing from the nuts of people who's gotten me the best results out there. And if there's someone else who gets better results, then I'm going to swing from their nuts. So I apologize if this just turns into a little Dr. Harrison, slow the game down little plug. But that's it, man. I don't see or hear anyone, again, maybe they're out there, I just haven't seen it, that have gotten better results than what they have helped me with. So depends on the sport. Let's say for fast moving object, small moving object sports like hockey, baseball, softball, tennis, I'll say the use of the iTrack Brock string has helped tremendously with assessing athletes' convergence, their binocularity, and getting an understanding of how they perceive things. What's cool about that, it doesn't just check vision, it checks how the brain is taking information from the eyes. So if I have a baseball player who is a right-handed batter, their right eye perceives the string to be higher. So that means their left eye perceives it to be lower. They perceive things to be closer rather than further away. I know that they probably have a tendency to hit a lot of pop flies, but they're better at fastball hitters than they are at off speeds. You know what I mean? So I know now through the system, maybe some cues will do. One, we'll work on it. And two, some cues we'll do is we'll have them focus. Now, where are they focusing their attention? And you'll see based off of where they're focusing, sometimes their mechanics will change. So for that person that perceives things to be lower, I'll have them now focus maybe on the light part of the baseball. You know what I mean? Because there's a light and a dark side to a ball, you know, because the sun's and the lights are always up. So maybe I'll have them focus on the light part of the ball, aim small, miss small. So we'll look at that. That will maybe help them get them centered better. We'll work on tracking skills where they can identify it early but track it deep. So if they struggle with off speed, you know, with slower pitches, curves, changeups, whatever, you know, we'll work on more tracking skills so they're not just jumping so fast. Or maybe I'll have them work on pulling are opening up their stance a little more, or, you know, whatever, things like that. And we'll see improvements in our batters, and kind of the same idea with tennis. Now, tennis with a racket, there's a lot more room for error on a tennis racket than a baseball bat, but still some of the same stuff with that. So I would say that. And then also Dr. Harrison and Ryan also have a great app for iPhones, Androids, iPads for working on stereoscopic vision, working on 3D vision. They have a 3D vision app with videos and with pictures, all different types of pictures, general to specific. And so we use that, but we also have those pictures all over the walls on my gym. And we'll do a shit ton of stuff with that. So now, once you've gotten the information with the iTrack and Brockstring, if they don't have any issues, which we can get into, that's a whole other subject, man. You'll find some weird shit. When you learn how to assess athletes with that, you'll see athletes who are playing sports with just one eye, man. Their brain's only taking information from one eye. You're like, holy shit, you're this good. That just means if we get your other eye working and your brain taking it, then that you're just going to be that much better. But if they don't have any issues, then we work on their 3D vision and being able to see things in three dimensions, which is kind of important, which is going to help with depth perception and judging speed of ball movements and stuff like that. So I would say start there and then contact those guys, man. Anyone who's researched or read Joan Vickers' book, The Quiet Eye, awesome book. I read it. I'm like on my third time reading it. I'm still trying to understand it. But everything she talks about with gaze control and focus is what they teach practically. That's the thing. You know, can you practically do this shit? All this science is great, but if it doesn't practically apply, who really cares? So they actually teach how to focus, where to focus. You know, basketball coaches, for instance, will say, look at the front of the rim or look at the back of the rim. Well, what if they're nearsighted and you're having to look at the front of the rim? Well, they're more likely to hit the front of the rim or miss. You know what I mean? So I would have them focus on the back. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? Or maybe they're farsighted. So it depends on their perceptual skills. So I'm not going to just give a general cue of where to look if, you know, I haven't assessed their perceptual skills. So I would say look into anything by slow the game down first. And then if you're looking for tools and stuff and toys and things for your facility and stuff, then, I mean, they have great products. But then, you know, if you're looking to a DynaVision and stuff like that, I just did a podcast for Ultimate Athlete Concepts, kind of going through my little buyer's guide of all the vision tools out there, just what I've seen, because a lot of it's lacking. There's not a lot of – I look at the vision training, kind of how we do with athletic training, physical preparation from general to specific. A lot of it is just general. You know, you're just standing at this board or this TV looking at things. Well, you know what I mean? That's a little different than how a football field works or how a soccer field works or hockey. You know what I mean? Where it's an ever-changing environment. So how to take that stuff. And they really teach that from the general to on the field, on the court, on the diamond stuff. So that's why, again, I swing from their nuts.
Yeah, well, it's all good stuff. And I think that the awesome thing about vision training too is, as for strength coaches who, you know, we live and breathe the weights, but there's so much more. And just the weights can get, it's very simple and the simple things are effective, but the vision opens up so many possibilities and becomes that puzzle that I think that coaches can look at for, there's so much involved in it.
Absolutely. I don't know where I got it from, so I'm just going to take it as my own, but I work on the three B's, you know, brain, behavior, and the body. So we work on the biomechanics and stuff with Dr. Yeses and the strength training and this and that, and then the brain and behavior, where to focus and how to move and stuff like that. And we tie it together. You know, so I always play devil's advocate with my athletes. Well, how much of tennis is physical? They'll say, 50%. Well, how much is mental? 50%. Well, how much is visual? Well, okay, fuck. You know, we're working with a 300% pie here, man, in my opinion. So we work on all three of those. And that's I feel, important. If I'm trying to get the highest transfer of training, highest results on the field or court, then that's what I got. You know, that's what I'm going to do, everything I can to exhaust my means to do that, man.
Yeah, I think it's such a huge part of sport, especially ball sports, and underrated. And it'll be really amazing to see where that field is in 10, 20 years. And
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, there's always been that athlete. And just playing tennis and myself, you know, as a family sport, I'm not that good at it. But you always wonder why you missed that ball. Like, why did I miss that shot? Like, what? And after doing some vision training, it makes sense. And I think that's really changing the way that we look at that.
Yeah, it's really cool stuff, man. I'm really, really, really fascinated with it. And I don't know. I bother Dr. Harrison and Ryan all the time, man. So I know they're sick of me, but I know they were thinking about, and they were kind of working on doing some like seminars and some certification type stuff for coaches to start really getting that information out there of how to assess, static acuity, dynamic acuity, recognition, spatial orientation, hand-eye coordination, tracking skills, saccades. Saccadic movements and stuff like that. So, pursuit and all that stuff. So, anyone who's interested, check them out, man.
Cool. Well, I'm glad we had time to talk about vision a little bit, but that's all the time we have left for this one. So much great stuff, Jeff. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on. I learned a lot, and I'm sure everyone else listening did as well.
Thanks, Joel. I really appreciate it, man. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the show today. I hope you guys enjoyed listening to it as much as I did recording it. Please check out our sponsor, simplyfaster.com, and we will see you guys next week.